And a very warm welcome to The Sound of Economics Live. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel. And today I'm really pleased to host a podcast on the future of Ukraine in the European Union and what that future should look like and would look like and will look like. And there have been, of course, various proposals. The European Commission is discussing the issue as we speak. We'll take probably a decision tomorrow on its view that it wants to support for the EU for the Ukraine's accession status to the European Union. But there have been important players, including many member states, that have voiced their views. Different views on what they think Ukraine's position should be and whether Ukraine should get a candidate status or not and how Ukraine should eventually become a member of the European family, which is, of course, what the European Council in March already said, that it wants to seize Ukraine as part of the European family. So today we want to discuss this, and I'm really pleased to host two guests from Slovakia, Lubica Karvasova and Alexander Duleba. They both have worked on a concrete proposal for the Slovak government, and Lubica is actually advising the Prime Minister of the Slovak Republic. And Alexander is a senior fellow, but is also closely involved, a senior fellow at a foreign policy think tank in Bratislava, but is also closely involved with the Prime Minister's office and discussing these issues, I guess, regularly with the policymakers in the Slovak Republic. And I am also very pleased and happy to host my dear colleague, André Sapir, senior fellow at Bruegel and professor emeritus of economics at the Université Libre de Bruxelles, the free university in Brussels. We want also to get your questions and remarks from the audience. And if you want to ask a question, please do a go on our on a website, on a browser, and type in Slido. Slido is actually, as I just found out, a Slovak company. So go on Slido, and we've been using them without knowing that it's a Slovak company. So it's a company that allows you to type in a code. The code is membership, and if you type in that code, you can actually directly ask questions, which I will see here on my smartphone and be able to read and give and pass on to our speakers. So please do engage in the conversation. I think it's very important that we hear the views of our audience here in this podcast that is live streamed. So without much further ado, Lubica, thank you so much for joining us today. And give us the take and the background of why, what kind of future of the Ukraine in the European Union you see.
Well, first of all, thanks a lot, Guntram, for taking time to discuss such an important, especially as you just outlined, we're expecting on Friday the Commission's opinion on Ukraine, but not just on Ukraine as candidate status, but also on Moldova and Georgia. That's a broader picture that we have to have in mind while discussing these things. And then we have the European Council next week, Thursday, Friday. So this is really the make or break period before that. We're still trying also with Alexander to talk to many of our colleagues around the EU to build common grounds and to build a decision that will next week come and we will be unifying between ourselves, because these times require leadership. It's not business as usual, where you're trying to work on the lowest common denominator of each and every sectoral policy that we go through in the European Union. This is a leadership issue for all of us and also for the EU, where you really have to take a stance. And there have been a lot of discussions whether Ukraine in the EU is black or white or a binary question with a binary answer, yes or no. For us, it's very clear that it's yes. And Alexander will say a bit more also on the rationale. And I know what you don't want us to talk too long, so I'll be very, very short, just saying that on the 24th of February, for us, the relationship between EU and Ukraine didn't start. We were actually quite active during this government already before the war, trying to bring Ukraine closer to the EU and to the EU standards, even without knowing that actually in a couple of months we'll face the invasion of Russia to Ukraine. And the question of should Ukraine become member of the EU will be on the table. We were not expecting this, but already somehow being part of the process before that. On the 24th of February, Russia basically redesigned the map, be it in security terms, be it in geopolitics in Europe. And for us, it became quite clear that actually, the primary objective of current times is that Ukraine must win the war. And that is something that we should all have in mind. And that means not just weapons, as many member states would say, that's, of course, is extremely important. And everyone is trying to do its utmost, including small countries like ours, to deliver as much air defense and weapons as possible. But we believe that EU's future is part of the bigger package that Ukrainians deserve and that we should somehow put on the table. Weapons are important, but they won't be likely enough for Ukraine to also to win the war, but also to know what they're fighting for in the future. So I think we've been quite clear on that since the war began, also with Alexander, and that's also one of the reasons why we put forward a plan for Ukraine, because we didn't want this to be just, you know, ideological debate, yes or no, but we wanted to put some concrete elements on the table, what that could actually mean for Ukraine to become a candidate country, how we can shape it, what is the special track that we can offer Ukrainians. And we started to discuss that with member states, and we'll still do in the current days. So I would maybe give the floor over to Alexander.
Yeah, so thank you, Lubica. I mean, I think very clear message, very clear pro-Ukrainian message, and I think we all probably in this call want Ukraine to win this war. And I think it's important to actually say this. And I'm really grateful to you that you say it so clearly. And I hope that, of course, we are all aware that this is a war that affects all of us deeply. And so I think this commitment to supporting Ukraine, both short-term with weapon, but also financial support in the short-term is very, very important. And I've been writing on the financial support that I think is really crucial in the short-term beyond the weapons. I mean, the weapons is absolutely crucial, as you say, but the financial support is crucial. But then there's also sort of the more visionary part, which is about, I guess, giving hope or giving a perspective to a country that, of course, is now in an extremely difficult situation where the East option of Ukraine has become basically impossible. I mean, trade with Russia is unlikely to ever pick up again. And so I think sort of thinking about the option for Ukraine towards the West is really crucial. And there, I guess, comes in the question of EU membership and what kind of EU membership. And perhaps, Alexander, you can give us your take and I think the Slovak government's take on what is it that you are really concretely proposing. I mean, are you saying Ukraine should join very quickly, or how do you see the membership?
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Guntram, for having us today afternoon. In our understanding, in our reading of the situation, I'm not going to repeat the scenarios which we have on the table. The worst one, which was already mentioned by Lubica, is that Russia is successful, and that would mean a militarization of our societies, our budgets. You know, because you can raise many arguments, moral, political, etc. But also, let's start from the argument which is quite hard in the EU capitals. So as Lubica said, we already had several sort of the series of meetings and discussions with experts from in the various capitals. You know, the only scenario, if Russia is successful in this war, is the militarization of our lives. That means militarization of our budgets. And actually, that means also the, you know, reduced sources for a green transition, for modernization projects and strategic objectives. Actually, we have, and as we understand, our future prosperity. We have to prevent that situation. And this brings us to this argument, which was clearly stated by Lubica, that we have to support and we need to help Ukraine simply to win, because it's our war. It's not just Ukrainian war. And it's, you know, we cannot simply observe this war as happening something in Ukraine, you know, more than 1,000 kilometers, you know, from our borders, and it will not have a sort of the impact, you know, on our lives and our societies. Therefore, we argue that if the EU, let us not repeat the mistake we made once already in 2014. Some could argue that also it was made in 2008, that we helped to create geopolitical vacuum, which simply, you know, helped Putin to unleash a war, which we, you know, which is after the World War II, the first full-scale invasion of one European state, you know, against another one, etc. Let's stop this chapter. We cannot simply, we have to bring and put on the table solutions that will close this chapter of the very sort of the dramatic, you know, events so we are confronting now in order to save our own future. So this is at the stake. And if we want to close this chapter, if we want to reduce the geopolitical vacuum, which we also help by our sort of reluctant, you know, approach towards what happened in Ukraine in 2014, occupation of Crimea, et cetera, part of Donbas, let's close it. We cannot have a together solution which will just postpone or just, you know, put it, you know, somewhere in the future. Let's solve it now, right now, because if you'll not manage this conflict and everything what it means for us right now, it will simply, you know, occur again in some period of time. So this is the challenge. And from you know, departing from this understanding and reading on the situation, we think that EU should it changes also paradigm of the enlargement policy of the EU in Eastern Europe. So this is something special what we want to like to, you know, highlight and raise in all these discussions, that actually if we will not be able to anchor Ukraine firmly in the EU integration project based on the EU, if we simply will not manage, you know, to get Ukraine on the board, that is our failure. So the change of paradigm of the enlargement policy in Eastern Europe is that it's not only homework for Ukraine to meet the criteria, to harmonize with the EU, with the institutions, etc., you know, acquis communautaire, but also it's our homework. So this is something what is new. It's another sort of the external country, I mean, which is, you know, like, so developments there do not have a direct impact on us. We have to, it's our war, and by our means, we have to stop it and simply to close this chapter in order not to prevent its, you know, sort of, you know, recurrence, you know, in the future. Mm-hmm. And therefore, this is a change, the enlargement, sort of the paradigm, change paradigm of the enlargement policy. Therefore, we are not saying membership tomorrow. We are not saying that Ukraine should be like, you know, sort of incorporated into the club and into the, you know, the institutions of the EU, you know, tomorrow. Not, it should meet all the requirements. You know, it should be like all the requirements we can identify within the European Union that the candidate countries should meet, you know, in order to become the members. So this is what we are, what our plan includes is the mechanism which refer to the Slovakia's experience of 2000-2003, because also we manage a sort of the fast-track enlargement process in Slovakia. Because our neighbors, Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary, so they started negotiation talks like 99. Slovakia started only in 2000 after the change of the parliament in 2008 and it took still 2 years for Slovakia to get on the track. But then actually we have some very special experience. And I would summarize it in the very fact that the European Commission was very helpful to Slovakia. They established a high-level group for Slovakia, which was really very helpful to streamline the sort of the approximation, you know, and harmonization with the European acquis. Also, it was very important on first our neighbors helped us. Czechs, Poles, Hungarians shared with ours, you know, this experience, and it managed for us to all this accession process like within 4 years. We catch up. We managed that. And we understand what was important for Slovakia, and we included in our proposal, you know, having in mind, so this sort of geopolitical, how to say, the argument, which I try to simply briefly explain what is at the stake, how to simply make this integration of Ukraine, you know, faster. But it doesn't mean that it should become member tomorrow. Okay. These are just instruments. I can elaborate on that. They draw on the Norwegian model. So
let's move on the, I mean, we can talk about sort of the instruments and the precise approach, I guess, in a minute. But I do want to bring in André at this stage to sort of give us his view on the broader picture. I mean, you made a very clear plea that for geopolitical reasons and to avoid a vacuum in Ukraine, a power vacuum, we need to really quickly move on EU membership. And of course, while respecting the entire process of, you know, the accession process, still, I mean, make sure that basically there's no vacuum and Ukraine soon becomes a member. André, what is your take on this issue?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me try to react to the concrete proposal made by Alexander, which I think is quite reasonable, obviously, not only to grant Ukraine candidate status, but to start the negotiation fairly rapidly and to use some of the technology that was used by earlier candidate countries, including Slovakia. And as was said, Slovakia, among the member states that joined the European Union in 2004, was not among the early batch of countries to start the negotiation. Actually, it started the negotiation fairly late compared to some of the other countries, but it concluded the negotiation together with the others and joined at the same time in May 2004. And so, as was just said, I think it's in March 2000 that Slovakia started the negotiation, you know, a couple of years later than some of the others. But then indeed there was a fast track process, as Alexander indicated. And I think a good question to ask from a very pragmatic, I'm not going to engage into sort of ideological discussions, which one could. I want to be very, very pragmatic, as Alexander was. You know, said Slovakia joined late the train of negotiation, but, you know, was able to join a fast-moving train and really do it very, very well. And as he said, I think benefited from the experience of other countries, and the Commission was a great help. So can we replicate that and how with respect to Ukraine? So I think that's what I want to discuss again from a very pragmatic, rather than to say, should we not grant status, and you know what does it mean? You know, assuming this is, you know, we want to grant status, and we would like that after granting the candidate status, one is able to launch the negotiation fairly soon, and having launched the negotiation, to reach the end of the negotiation fairly soon. Now, my sense is that this is feasible, but very difficult. So I think that the situation where Slovakia was when it hopped onto the train, this fast-moving train, in March 2000, the situation, and even leaving aside the war, I mean, that's a big, it's a big leaving aside, obviously, the war, but leaving that aside, let's say we were 6 months ago, before the war. Okay, so look at the situation of Ukraine then. And can I say that, I mean, from just looking at the data and the objective elements, was Ukraine in a condition 6 months ago to be able to replicate what Slovakia did back then? My sense is that the answer is no. So there are two ways to look at this. I mean, and I'm just looking at in terms of, you know, where in terms of the reforms, in terms of the shape of the criteria that we have for membership, that, you know, Alexander and Lubica indicated that, you know, we want to fulfill them all, right? So we may want to fast track, but fast track does not mean that we don't want to consider all the criteria. We don't want shortcuts. We may want to help very much Ukraine to fulfill the criteria, but all the criteria need to be fulfilled. So my sense is that 6 months ago, before the war, Ukraine was not in such a shape that it could easily, I'm not saying at all, but easily replicate what Slovakia did, which was quite extraordinary in a sense.
And is it now, André? Has the situation improved?
No, even less. No, even less. So, but again, that's why I want to abstract from the war for a moment. So the question I want to put forward, and I don't have the answer, obviously, is how can we? I don't think it's sufficient to say, well, Slovakia did, and this is the way Slovakia did it. And yes, Slovakia did it, and very successfully, with in the manner that was explained very well by Alexander. Can we sort of simply replicate that for Ukraine? I think no. I think some additional needs to be put, and that's, I think, what needs to be discussed.
Right.
This additional element that, given the economic conditions of Ukraine before the war, this is what needs to be done. We need something new, then we need to discuss the war.
Right. So, André, I do want to give, I mean, we sort of didn't discuss the more geopolitical question. And, you know, I do want to push you on that. And there are a number of people actually asking questions on that already. But before moving again back sort of to the big picture question, where the geopolitical question, I do want to sort of stay on the technical point that you made and get Alexander to react, of course, because I mean, there is a person here, just to give that sense. I mean, so, Mr. Anonymous, he says, well, I understand the urge to help, but is Ukraine ready to join the EU anytime soon in terms of economy, democracy, corruption? That's a question coming up here from someone in our audience. And of course, I mean, we can disagree how far Ukraine is, and we can have a conversation on that. But I think we should also have quite a pragmatic discussion. What can the EU do to support also in the current situation? And there are, of course, issues around the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development. I mean, there's not many institutions that beyond the Commission can actually concretely help. And arguably, and there perhaps André, views can also differ. Under President Zelensky, the structural situation in Ukraine in terms of the public administration, the fight against corruption, had already improved prior to the war quite a bit, and that's certainly something to debate. So let me get Lubica and Alexander to, I mean, perhaps shortly react on this little bit more technical point, but I think it's important to have a view on this to get a sense how quickly can Ukraine actually join. So okay. Lubica, perhaps you start.
If yeah. I may jump in quickly. The fast track term is maybe not the right one to be used because it's often abused by more skeptical part of the EU, saying that we somehow want to undermine the criteria and EU standards, etc. No, we therefore prefer to also talk about special assistance or special track for Ukraine. It's very difficult, as I understand Andre's point, to abstract from the war. And that's one of the pillars, actually, on which we are based, and our approach is based, that it is a country in war, like it or not. And we have to adapt our know-how from the previous years, including the one on Slovakia that was used, to the current circumstances and to the possibilities that Ukraine has in the future. That means, in practical terms, for instance, we are building a post-war reconstruction fund or recovery plan 2.0, if you like, where not just the EU, but also other countries and other stakeholders might join. We might have common needs assessments. So that would be a shared common effort at some point to rebuild Ukraine. And what we argue is that it's not like pre-accession assistance that we know from the previous times, like IPA fund or anything else. It's something very special, very genuine, which can have a very strong reform and investment element in it, which would be new. We know it as EU member states, and we have a recovery plan as one of the flagship priorities of the current government in the country, in Slovakia. So we somehow can use this experience and let also Ukraine to see how they could somehow start combining reforms with investments, of course, at the point where they will be able to do so after the war, and how we can link that into their EU path and EU standards. So you would have somehow a bit different structure and different governance of that path and that accession period, which has nothing to do what was there in the past when Slovaks were trying to become a member. So it builds on that experience, but it is actually adapted to the needs of Ukraine very specifically. Mm. And we want to keep it very specific because it is a general situation and we've never tackled this type of situation.
No, but that's an important point, of course, that the situation has to be adapted to the conflict and the war, and so I mean, in that regard, I mean, perhaps really also very shortly, still on the technical, and then I do want to ask the geopolitical questions that come in. But on the technical, there's, I mean, a related question which basically says, well, how would the state of the rule of law, for example, in Ukraine, be technically measured by the Commission in the accession process, when we have this kind of conflict, you know, the current situation. So I mean, it's a very technical point. And you see some of our audience sort of EU aficionados that I guess know very much the details of the accession process. And so I guess just to get you on this one technical point, and then, you know, I do want to move on and really ask about the more geopolitical questions. So Alex, perhaps very quickly.
Very, very briefly. First, Ukraine is implementing accession agreement since 2015. I did my research as an academician, and I did in-depth research of the accession. I compared it with the EA agreement, with the Swiss sort of bilaterals, the agreements between Switzerland and the Turkish customs, etc., etc. Actually, my finding main finding from this research was that this DCFT part of the agreements includes 95% of the trade economic related acquis of the European Union. 95% of the trade economic related acquis, they already implemented 60% of that. So they will not starting from the point zero. There is something very important and significant, you know, so work was already, you know, is done in this sense. Second, fast track doesn't mean fast outcome. Doesn't mean. What we are offering is the instruments how to facilitate, how to streamline the process, what the European Commission and then the member states can offer and deliver to Ukraine in order to manage the process. We do not say that membership tomorrow. Again, this is the question about the, what you quoted from the slide, though, how it is possible to measure another progress in the time of war. Of course, it's impossible. And of course, we are not, again, we are not saying membership tomorrow. What I see as a program maximum for Ukraine in political terms, having in mind our interest that are at stake in Eastern Europe is candidate status. Candidate status, because it's only the third or fourth step. There is a 12 other, you know, sort of the steps in the enlargement process that the applying countries should pass and negotiating position, intergovernmental conference, etc., etc. So we are far from that. But now, you know, having in mind what is at stake, and it's that it's about our the future shape of our own budgets, what we need to do and to deliver to Ukraine to give politically this candidate status, and that's all what we can do during the war. This is clear, and this is my response to all the other questions and technicalities.
Yeah,
we can work together with Ukrainian government. As Lubica already mentioned, we already started before the war. So we came up with a strategy how to upgrade our relations, and one third of that was one package, the three pillars, what to us is Ukraine in the implementation of the association agreements. We created 8 working groups, 15 Slovak state agencies were involved, 20 Ukrainian agencies. And so simply, so we identified the most difficult sectorial policies for them to harmonize with the EU acquis. And again, we did analysis what we can deliver, where, I mean, it's Slovakia works well within the EU acquis. We created working groups, started to work. It's possible. If we have like more than 10 willing governments of the EU member states, and if we will just, you know, divide the sort of the labor between us, and each government will take over 2-3 sectorial policies, the most complicated, which includes these regulatory policies and frameworks, we can deliver within 3 years if there is a peace. Right. Not if it is a war.
The last word concerning
the funding, reconstruction, because really it's very important what Lubica already indicated. There is a sort of the Marshall Plan for Ukraine, you know, so it's under preparation. And many donors, not only the EU, the United States, Canada, Japan, Singapore, New Zealand, Australia, and other countries and donors, international financial institutions are ready to contribute to reconstruction of Ukraine. I think it is a task for the European Commission and for the member states simply to include European integration of Ukraine as a sort of the guarantee of the sustainable development of Ukraine, so that this is a value that should be a part of the program and should be supported also by non-EU member states like the United States, like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Singapore, Japan, etc. So we can raise by this way a different funding for the to support European integration of Ukraine, but it should be included into the plan, the recovery plan, as a relief, reconstruction and reforms, including European integration process. So we can find a financial solution that will not sort of create problems for the Western Balkan countries or for, you know, the EU budget.
Right. So I think this is, of course, an important point that EU membership and the prospect of accession, the candidate status, is a very good mechanism of anchoring institutional stability and ensuring that reconstruction money, if the war is over, is actually used in a sensible way. And If I can just sort of move a bit more in the geopolitical direction, and I do want to give the floor also to André, but I mean, just to say on the geopolitical arguments, I was, to be honest, when all of this discussion, not today, but in the last months started, I was initially quite skeptical about giving Ukraine a candidate status. And my position has actually moved. And I think it's the right thing to do at the current situation because of the geopolitical situation and the need to clearly give a perspective to Ukraine to be anchored in the European project and to have this option towards the West and to make it clear that you know what Vladimir Putin did and is still doing is actually unacceptable. And so my, in a sense, my view has moved in that direction, but I'm sure not everybody's view has moved. And of course, a full membership of Ukraine in the EU, once it is in the EU, has many, many implications. And let me just mention one, which is here asked by Frederic Mauro. He's asking, well, But how would Article 42.7 of the treaty, which is the collective defense clause, work if Ukraine becomes a member state? I mean, it is very close to Article 5 in the NATO context. So it immediately raises, of course, also not just sort of promises for financial support, but also, of course, there's a clear security dimension to EU membership, which I guess is one reason why I think Slovakia is supporting it, which is also reason why I guess some individuals are skeptical. So perhaps André, you give us your take on, you know, how is this geopolitical game going to look like if Ukraine is in the EU or were to become a member of the EU?
Guntram, you said that your view has evolved, and you know. My view has evolved as well. You know, we are fact-based people, and so we have observed the reality over the last few months, and obviously we have had to revise our views. And you know, I also feel obviously that one needs to give Ukraine prospects given what has happened since February, so I've no doubt about that. And one of the elements where I've revised my views perhaps is in thinking that we collectively made a huge mistake by not giving Ukraine membership to NATO. And that perhaps had we given, we again collectively the NATO members, the current NATO members, had we given Ukraine membership, maybe we would not be where we are. But I'm wondering whether, you know, you're referring to the article of collective help in the EU treaty that's sort of reminiscent of NATO. Obviously, the EU treaty may have a text which is not unlike what we have in NATO, but the EU does not have the military capability that NATO has. So I'm really wondering whether, if we are talking here mostly geopolitics, we need not to talk about NATO membership. Mm. Remember that for all of the Central and Eastern countries, they joined NATO, I think all of them, I believe, before they joined the European Union. So if we think that by joining the EU, this is going to take care of the security need of Ukraine, and the security need is real, I'm not underestimating, obviously, at this stage, I'm wondering whether we are not partly fooling ourselves. We are not fooling them, right, and fooling ourselves, that, you know, this is, we did not want to give you NATO membership. We still don't want to give you NATO membership, but we are going to give you EU membership. And EU membership is great.
So let's,
but
let's
is
ask
it going to fulfill this,
let's the geostrategic need? Let's ask Lubica. I mean, are we having the wrong debate? I mean, are we talking about EU membership while we should be talking about NATO membership at this stage? Or why EU membership, not NATO membership? Is it related to a fear to provoke Russia, or are you also in favor of NATO membership, Lubica?
Well, first of all, I would make it a separate discussion. Really, because there are two tracks which in some ways can be seen as parallel, but not necessarily. We also have countries in the EU, although less and less, to be honest, that are not part of NATO, but are part of the EU. And here I mean our Finnish and Swedish colleagues, which have completely changed their mind quite recently as well. So there are interferences and interconnections between the two. I think when it comes to Ukraine, it is in a very specific geopolitical space, also geographical space, where security guarantees must be there. And they are part of the discussions with several countries around the EU or the world as well, to see how we can guarantee their stability in the future in security terms. But it's kind of a discussion that is now being taken or put forward outside the NATO framework. But it's there and it's being discussed. Then you have EU membership, which is rather responding to the request also of the Ukrainian population and of their citizens, who actually believe, and the reason why they're fighting is really to adhere to the EU values, which are part of democracy values, and to a certain extent also to largely rule of law. And Ukraine is very much aware that rule of law is part of the EU values that have to be respected once you're a member. I think we learned a lesson on this. So I think for right now, also to respond to Ukrainian aspirations, the right thing to do is to really discuss EU candidate status, which again, I would say it's like you're getting a ticket, a feet in a race, and you can put your feet on the starting line. That's it. And then there is a long way until the line. So this is the stage where we are, and we should not complicate things too much either.
Right. So
if I may just add.
I think, Lubica, it's a very important point that, the aspiration, and I think we also need to remind ourselves how important EU membership is, of course, for economic convergence. And so the aspiration of citizens, I think that you emphasize so much, is something that Slovakia or Poland have actually experienced. I mean, the convergence of Poland towards in income levels towards Western European levels has been spectacular, in particular if you compare it with the much worse performance of countries of Ukraine itself. So EU membership is extremely important. It is extremely important for the economic and political aspirations. But I do want to, and Alexander, I will come to you, but I do want to bring in further questions from the audience. And there's a very live and active sort of set of questions here. And, you know, this one question here is by Milan Nitsch, who is actually going to be a future colleague of mine at the German Council on Foreign Relations in Berlin. Who is actually asking about the internal questions of the European Union, and he's asking about the internal EU mindset on enlargement. Big difference to 2004. It's not just the war, but also the internal EU mindset. Is the Ukraine war, the war in Ukraine, a chance to revive it? We might remember that when the association agreement was discussed, it was actually rejected. in I think the Netherlands and I believe also France. There were other countries that were very skeptical, at least. And also now, if I may, there are still skeptical voices. And I think France and Emmanuel Macron, for example, have talked more of a political community instead of the membership prospect. So I do want to get sort of Alexander, your take, but also André, your take on that issue, which is the more sort of internal kitchen. Alexander, perhaps you can share more the view that you got from also the interactions with other officials. And André, I mean, perhaps you can give us a sense also where you see the discussion in France on this issue.
Alex. Okay, very briefly. So we have like two categories or two groups of experts and politicians, you know, when it comes to the things and how to approach the issue of Ukraine. And it depends on whether they agree or disagree with the statement that Europe after this war will be no more like it was before. You have people who really understand that this is a dramatic change. And we simply have to respond. We cannot ignore that, because otherwise we will pay too much for our sort of the incapacity to deliver now and to manage our interests in Eastern Europe. And then you have people who think that, okay, so as a scenario, we can, to the business as usual, because the politicians, you know, so they're confronted with the growing inflation, energy prices, et cetera, et cetera. It would be possible to agree somehow with Putin and so on. We do not need, you know, to continue the sanctions and so on. So we have two mindsets. And yes, I would say that the number of the member states who were clearly against, like granting Ukraine candidate status even 1 month ago was much bigger than now. Now it is reduced to 3-4 countries. You know, and then we have like some other countries, they would like to offer something different, not like the candidate status, but like potential candidate status or candidate status with the conditions, etc. I think all that is manageable, but the candidate status should be there. I think program maximum for our policy, what we can and we should deliver now to Ukraine is a candidate status plus relief in financial terms during the war. All the rest, all other issues could be managed, yes, if there will be like the normal situation and peace will be, in place. And this is why NATO membership is out of the question now, because this was the offer of Ukrainians to Russians. Okay, actually, I mean, this was the main argument Putin used, that we have to prevent the NATO membership of Ukraine. They started this war and Ukrainians said, okay, we are not aspiring now. So let us, this was the main offer of Ukraine to start the peace talks with Russia. We are resigning on our NATO membership aspiration, and let us try to identify the other set of guarantees for national security. But the EU is a different issue. It's about the future. It's about the modernization. And it's 91% of Ukrainians following the last public poll survey by the rating agency, so that identify they support EU membership. 91% of Ukrainians support EU. So this is a clear message.
It's about
almost 70% of the citizens of the EU member states. And here again, for those skeptics, let's not repeat the mistake. Let us deliver what we can and should deliver now. Candidate status plus relief when it comes to financial terms. Then you can identify your conditions for Ukrainians, what they to have to meet, okay, implement, rule of law, whatever,
right,
before the European Council will make a next step in the process and to identify the
conditions. Yes,
okay?
Right. Okay. I think this is very clear. André, I have to say my thinking, I mentioned that my thinking has shifted. And my thinking has shifted because I think I see more the historic dimension of what is happening now than I used to a few months ago. And it's, I think, because of this historic dimension, I think we are seeing Ukraine emerging as a really strong Western-oriented liberal democracy. And I think this is for me, and really in fight with a very liberal, dictatorial almost regime in Russia, which, by the way, has been an imperial power for not just a few years, but I would say centuries. And you know, where the hope that Russia might change is perhaps also misplaced. So this is more than sort of a technical issue. Obviously, it's a highly political issue, and I think it's an issue of historic dimension. And my sense at the moment is that those that advocate for EU candidacy quickly are perhaps on the right side of history, but perhaps you see it differently, André. Or
no, I can subscribe very much to what Alexander said. Alexander said two things. Number one, candidate status. Number two, relief and reconstruction. Seems to me very reasonable. Now, I think my task is to go beyond that. So having, you know, signed to this, I need to also think forward beyond this. And the only point that I will make, and, you know, please don't misunderstand me. So I'm willing very much to sign to those two basic elements, candidate status and relief. Now, I'm already looking forward. Okay, candidate status has been granted. Now, let's move forward. My view is that the starting point in terms of the conditions, the normal conditions that we use to judge membership, those conditions are not great. And again, I'm looking at the numbers before the war. I'm looking at what I have in front of me are indicators coming from EBRD, where EBRD is having those convergence criteria on a number of issues, including competitiveness, including governance, and comparing all of the countries that are members of the EBRD. When I'm looking, and those are the numbers for 2021, so that's why I'm abstracting from the war. There, in my view, simply looking at the numbers, this is not my personal preference, the numbers are not great for Ukraine. This is what I... So it's not a question of whether my heart bleeds for Ukraine or not, whether I disagree with the 91% of the Ukrainian who want to have the same standard of living as I do. Sure. I mean, I would be Ukrainian. I would be exactly in the same situation. But I think we have also to look at the functioning of the European Union. And there, that's why I don't want to take shortcuts. And I fear, and that's why the EU will not provide the security. That's why I wanted to eliminate that discussion. We will not provide the security that NATO can provide. So let's forget about that. So what we can provide is an environment where indeed citizens of Ukraine can improve their standard of living, as other countries, as Slovakia, as other countries that have joined the European Union in recent years have done. And that's perfectly legitimate. But as I said, the starting point is not great. And therefore, it's incumbent upon us, after having granted the candidate status, not to say, well, no, you have candidate status and suddenly you will jump to membership. There'd be a huge task. And that's what I want to hear. But maybe you say, okay, this is a discussion to have in 2 weeks after the status has been given. You know, now let's fight for the status. And after that, we can fight for the other. So my mind on the other, and that's all.
No, I think this is, of course, an excellent point and a fair point. And I do want to get, Lubica, perhaps from you, the last word on the discussion about what does it take also for EU reform? I mean, do we need to, once Ukraine has gotten the candidate status and we are sort of getting serious about getting Ukraine into the EU. I mean, there's lots of questions about how the EU operates currently, right? And I think an important argument that you would hear in Paris is well, it's all great to enlarge, but you know, already now the EU at 27 has become so difficult to manage. We have unanimity, and then we have sort of individual countries such as Hungary that block us on everything, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a common agricultural policy that takes up half of our budget and is very ineffective in many respects, et cetera, et cetera. So there's lots of, I think, reform debates that we all know and we all have contributed to them. But do you see this as a sort of great grand bargain that could come out once Ukraine has a candidate status, that we have a sort of serious discussion, all of us, and we reform the EU as part of the process of getting the Ukraine as a full member?
Well, certainly I would see these discussions interlinked, but they can be held parallel. I don't think we need to take hostage in neither of the discussions, whether it's EU reform first and Ukraine or vice versa. They can go in parallel, but I think first we need to really make clear whether enlargement is part of our DNA or not. So far, my understanding, and I believe understanding of many in the EU, was that this is part of our future. Look at the Western Balkans. I mean, there are a number of countries where we discuss accession. So it should be in our DNA that we want to expand, for example, and to actually invite all countries that want to apply for EU membership. And are committed to deliver on that in terms of standards, let them do that, give them the chance. And then at the end of the process, it will be again us 27 to decide yes or no. There are lots of yes or no in the process. So I don't think there's anything to be worried about. And if we want to keep EU strong and it's actually power even higher, I'm not sure we can achieve it through changing unanimity into QMV voting, that would make the trick. I'm not so sure about that. But if you're able to have to close, as Alexander said, the geopolitical vacuum around you by taking up members who are ready to be part of EU, then I think you're much, much stronger than... imagine having Ukraine, 44 million people, who are a liberal democracy, who respect the rule of law, who are increasing their living standards. They're huge. They can be huge contribution into the EU's power, even worldwide, not just regionally. So I think we should look in our future in a more optimistic way of thinking, and not to be too much afraid. We've been afraid before, and I think it's time to have courage to do bigger steps.
Okay. Thank you, Lubica. This was, thank you, Alexander. Thank you, André. I think this was a very stimulating discussion. And as we can see, there's sort of many, many issues which we, of course, should zoom in much more. But I'm afraid we only have this 1 hour for our discussion. And, you know, I really think it's a very important topic. And it is important for Ukraine, but I think it's really also important for the identity that we as European Union have. I mean, what kind of union do we want? And perhaps your word of courage is an important one. And so I think this really deserves further discussions. So in the meantime, let me just thank all of you for being here, for discussing with us, and also our audience for really being so engaged in this debate and, you know, giving so many great questions. It was a real pleasure to host this podcast live today. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye.